So I'm here today with Daniel Brown from Nottingham Trent University. So would you like to start off by telling me a little bit about what you do?
Well, I'm a professional astronomer and I teach astronomy at Nottingham Trent University to our students. I also look after the on-site observatory that's there as well. And as part of teaching astronomy, I also do a little bit of research, and I'm born and bred theoretical astronomer. So I really do modeling stellar evolution, looking at how stars rotate. But on the side, I also do research in archaeoastronomy. So that's linking archaeology and astronomy together to try to understand how peoples of modern time, past, present, understood what's happening in the sky and endowed the sky with certain meanings as well.
So how did you end up kind of, so if going from a really theoretical part of astronomy in stellar evolution, I mean, getting into something which I imagine is quite practical in archaeoastronomy, how did you end up moving between those?
So what happened is that actually a venue like this, being a young researcher in Germany, I got into archaeoastronomy. So one of the first posters that I presented in astronomy was on archaeoastronomy. So in my sort of in Germany, the second to third year, so fourth, fifth, sixth semester, I got involved in a project that was building a modern-day Stonehenge and archaeoastronomy-themed park on a rejuvenated slag heap, and that was building a gigantic sundial and a big display to illustrate how stars move in the sky. And that got me into looking at archaeoastronomy, and some of the researchers at our institute were involved in archaeoastronomy. So that's how I started to develop interest. So very much like the crowd you would find here. So young researchers, ones that are just graduated, PhD students that are presenting their work. That's the kind of audience and atmosphere that I was in when I was getting involved in that. And a lot is also because I'm quite interested, or was always interested in astronomy when I was in school already. So I was a quite passionate amateur astronomer. So that brought my kind of practical instincts there as well. So very much why I found it very, very important to come to this kind of venue, because I really felt it's something important to continue the presence of archaeoastronomy, or cultural astronomy, as some people call it as well, in this venue, and make sure that astronomers, when they're doing their degree, are well aware of these kinds of aspects of the discipline as well.
Okay, that's great to hear. So what would you be able to tell us and our listeners a little bit about a recent archaeoastronomy project you might have worked on, or something you've contributed to give kind of a flavour of what kind of work goes on in that field?
Well, at the moment, I've been involved in two things, one of which is looking at the heritage of the night sky, where I've been involved in a dark sky project in the Peak District. So we've been looking at how light pollution can actually hinder seeing the beauty of the night sky. And therefore, if you think on our heritage, we're thinking about monuments, we're thinking about landscape features, but that all extends into what we call skyscape, what's visible above. And if we include light pollution, we're eradicating what was there and what can be seen at these sites. So in a way, it's as if you would run a bulldozer through Stonehenge. That would cause a big outcry. That's what we wanted to foster, this understanding of that the night sky is a piece of our heritage as well. And soon as we manage to do that kind of outreachy project, we would foster a better understanding and motivation in sort of ground roots from the population to sort of support dark skies. The other one that I was working on was looking at orientation of a standing stone in the Peak District in Gardam's Edge, which is a fantastic site, a very unusual standing stone in this area, very triangular in shape. And the idea there is that rather it pointing to a specific alignment on the horizon where the sun might set in midwinter or midsummer, it's actually something where the shadows play quite an interesting story in this stone. So the stone is set up so that it at midday, midsummer, the sun is highest in the sky, and the shadow cast by this stone doesn't appear on the ground at all. It's actually not formed so that the shadow seemingly is shorter than what the stone is. It actually, if you would limit the standing stone to only a staff that's at the front edge of it where the sun hits it, that shadow cast by that staff would exactly now be modeled in stone. So the one north-facing side is just being skimmed by the light as it comes in. So in a way, what I'm looking at now in the interpretation is that that standing stone is embodying its own shadow. Now you can look at skyscape experience, as I was talking to in this conference as well, as being something where not only the sky or sky meets horizon, but also the land is playing an important role. You can see how shadows, as part of celestial bodies interacting with the land, can suddenly create these fascinating examples of light and darkness change. I mean, there's obviously fantastic examples of that in Mesoamerica, where you've got shadow casts onto the side of stairwells that imitate snakes running down the pyramids at the equinoxes as well. But very impressive, but this is small, but still a very meaningful thing, because shadows in our society have always this double meaning as something that's very essential for us. If you lose your shadow, you lose part of yourself, and you're endangering your own safety and sanity. And this is a very powerful expression trying to replace that shadow in stone.
So it sounds like they're a very powerful part of our local heritage, really, as well. So do we know what the significance of these standing stones are? So I'm not sure I've ever seen one, possibly.
It is very difficult. You can't say what is the significance. It's not as clear-cut as you would think in a science like astronomy, that this is how it works and this is not how it works. It's interpreting it from a point of view of who uses this science. So you will find the New Age community using these sites as powerful sites where they can tap into Earth energy fields. You will find people like us researchers to try to tap into the understanding of past people, how they would use and understand the sites and the sky as well. You would think about how ecologists would use these sites and seeing the erosion on the stone and trying to understand how our weather has changed and how acidic rain has impacted it. You would see environmental biologists trying to look at the sites to see how growth on the stones, mosses or lichen have changed over time as well. So it's many different users have many different angles on them. So I don't think you can say what the meaning is. And also, if there's many different cultural groups that have created standing stones, stone circles and the like. So it's very difficult to have a general meaning. So what we are very much proposing is this case-to-case study where you're looking actually at a small sample, still a sample so you can compare and contrast, but rather than looking at all of the sites across the UK, you would look at a very localized area in a valley or in a very distinct area where you know all the sites roughly built at 2000 BC were built by a similar kind of population with similar ideas. And that's where you can then look at how they understood the rising and the setting of the sun, depicting certain kind of powerful regions on the horizon and aligning their dead towards it and using it for ritual purpose. Not always like we're obsessed with calendars. So it might be calendaric, but not in a sense that they would have used these sites initially to hone a calendar to such a precision. It might be, you're imagining now a society that has no writing, if they set up a monument, you might think of a big obelisk we set up to remember the Battle of Waterloo 200 years ago. We put a plaque on the bottom and say, what do you mean? They have a monument that depicts a site that's regularly used for yearly gatherings of the clans of the area. You would have a monument that would clearly state and be functional, and you want to sort of ensure that meaning is encapsulated in it. They wouldn't have writing or scripture that would be put on there, but you would be able to, through orientation, through work of shadow casting, through alignments, to try to imbue this site with this meaning. So who knows, to access these things would see the importance. They would see that if you access it once a year, that it becomes important. In our day society, you can probably compare that. I use that example of the National Memorial Arboretum, where the main monument for remembrance is set up so that one gap representing sort of the opening door towards the afterlife lets light shine on through onto the central monument only on the 11th of the 11th, on the 11th hour. And that's a powerful expression of how we see meaning as well.
So the meaning of the monument is inherent in its construction itself. So rather than needing some plaque or something, it's all kind of encapsulated in there.
Very importantly, encapsulated in the monument, encapsulated in the landscape surrounding it, what people put into a meaning and context in what's around the landscape. Areas might be associated to death, powerful mountains, being able to see hilltop forts of residents, and also what is in the sky. So where the heavenly bodies like sun, moon, other planets or stars might rise or set as well. All of that playing together into what we would call skyscape experience.
Oh, that's fascinating. So what kind of tools and equipment do you use in your field? I seem to remember earlier you mentioned something about a flower pot and a helium balloon.
So one of the ways of surveying large sites, some of these stone circles can easily be in the 100 meters diameter, and some of these are large landscapes that you want to survey. So surveying, you can do that by mapping and grid reference, but you want to sometimes have a picture. I personally don't have the funds to fly a plane over the site to get the imagery, or have good enough connections with the White House to get appropriate satellite data. So you would have to opt to drones to fly over it. If you have the appropriate clearance and guidance to do so, that's as perfectly fine. That's what our archaeologists nowadays would be doing. Also doing some outreach projects with students, my year 10 project students, what we would do is find out how many helium balloons do you need to float a little spy USB webcam in a plant pot. You need probably a good dozen of them, and then we went into the field, went upwind, let them float up, and you have them on the tether line and release them to let float. They go with the wind over the site, and when they're reaching the site, you've got a camera that's easily 50 meters above the site taking images, then you wheel it back in, and you've got for free, you have to pay maybe £20 and B&Q for a helium canister, but you've got very good aerial views of that site as well. And that helps you to sort of see what's where, alignments, orientations, and a little bit of documentation. Other things you might need in the field are a good compass, a clinometer to measure how high certain things are, altitude or elevations. Because what we were talking to is where things rise or set on the horizon. So you need to know directions on the horizons, things due north. But that just gives you what's called an azimuth. And you want to then try to find out what for objects in the sky would be associated to that azimuth, where they would rise and set. And yes, you can use a perfect one that's sort of your zero altitude horizon, what you would see at a beach when you're looking over the sea. But actually, if you're in the mountainous environment, you can see hillsides there, so they elevate the horizon. So for example, the sun should go up at 8, but no way, you're at the bottom of the valley, you have to wait another 2 hours till it creeps over the mountain. And actually, suddenly, if you're at the equinox 21st of March, it doesn't creep up due east. Actually, it's much further to the south because it's been offset through the mountains. That's very important to actually include in the survey. So that's one important kit that we're using as well.
So you need all these tools to take into account these different effects. Okay, so that's very interesting. And thank you for giving us a kind of good overview of what you do and the different tools that you might use. So thanks for being on the Dreadcast.
Thank you very much.